From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With the end of the Cold War, only one superpower remained. Now the United States is indisputably the most powerful nation on Earth. But does the ability to scramble jets over Bosnia, beam TV sitcoms into Bahrain, or lay down business models in Brazil make America more than a superpower? Does it make America an empire? For many Americans, empire is a dirty word, with its images of tyrannical monarchs and oppressive power. But accidental empire or calculating superpower, it is the United States that leads the charge into the 21st century, a century that September 11th showed will be dramatically different than the last. Is America the new global empire? Should it be? In a time when the greatest threats are terrorist networks and not territorial states, does being an empire do America any good? Is it good for the world? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from London is Philip Bobbitt. He's a law professor at the University of Texas in Austin and, until 1999, was senior director for strategic planning at the National Security Council in Washington. His most recent and celebrated book is The Shield of Achilles, War, Peace, and the Course of History. Good evening and welcome, Philip Bobbitt.
Good evening.
Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Jack, I want to jump right in with you if I can. Michael Goldfarb and his documentary have given us a lot to chew on. What is it that makes this question of empire so endlessly magnetic? And to bring it right up to date, how does 9/11 figure in to this discussion of just how powerful we are and what it means?
Well, I think that empire for Americans has been, our debate over it has been a sort of act or version of the debate over American exceptionalism. Are we a nation unto, a light unto the nations? Are we a nation specially favored by providence that will not go the way of empires? Because I think empires, have
what goes up must come down.
What goes up must come down. And I think throughout our history, the feeling has been that if we emulate the other powers, the patterns of domination that have been handed down in history, then we betray our role, which is the role that I think William Jennings Bryan gives in that last quotation Michael has, where we rule by example. We're a city upon a hill. We achieve things for the world by achieving justice here. And again in America, justice has been delayed by war. The progressive era ended because of World War I. Mm. The New Deal, which gave Pope to millions of Americans, ended to fight World War II. Harry Truman's fair deal had to be sacrificed to fight the Korean War, and the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson had to be sacrificed for Vietnam.
So all these with a tinge of nativism about their concern, or at least of justice at home before power abroad.
That's right.
9/11, symbol of power or of vulnerability?
I think of vulnerability. I mean, I think one way to look at 9/11 is that the theory of American empire, and I use it in quotes, after World War II was stood on its head by 9/11. That theory was one of forward deployment. Mm-hmm. We'd learned from World War I, which was we've got to stop them over there before they come over here. So we deployed troops around the world, and we propounded doctrines, the Truman Doctrine, NATO, Japan. Dean Acheson said about, we've got to scare the hell out of the American people to get them into the world, to get them to buy this notion that our defense is found abroad. We stop the enemy before the enemy gets us here. And what we saw with 9/11 was that by the very things we thought were giving us security, meeting the enemy over there, deploying forward, was bringing harm to the homeland.
The whirlwind.
We were struck because we were deployed in Saudi Arabia. That seems to be one of Mr. Bin Laden's reasons. Precisely what we saw as a manifestation of strength was really the thing that the whole Cold War didn't have, we haven't had since 1812, brought harm to this country. So I think the whole theory of our empire has now really been thrown into question by what we saw happen. We can't find our security abroad anymore.
Philip Bobbitt, there's a mountain of power here, but does it add up to empire? And does that remain a core question in your mind?
Not really. I think it's quite a peripheral, indeed, almost a kind of entertainment question. The program we listened to, which I thought was extremely artfully done and very persuasive, has a kind of Hollywood logic to it.
And that is, in your mind.
A few examples. No country has ever been as dominant as we are, except possibly Rome and Britain. They were empires, therefore we're an empire. Empires had overseas colonies, we have overseas bases, therefore we're an empire. The word empire appears in Jefferson and Hamilton. They are our framers. T.R. was an imperialist. Brooks Adams was an imperialist. They're historical figures. Therefore, U.S. history is a history of imperialism. I thought it was very fitting that the program ended with a clip of Bryan, as if he were an imperialist. He was a pacifist. He was an isolationist. He resigned as Secretary of State when we went into World War I.
Which Jack Beatty points to here.
Absolutely, and I don't think empire is even relevant to what we faced in the 20th century, and certainly not after 9/11. There are criteria for imperial states. We know what they are. Imperial states have exploitative mercantile relationships with other states that they control. We certainly don't control Japan, whether or not Gore Vidal thinks that the prime minister has to report to the American president.
Or Chalmers Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Imperial cultures try to rub out other cultures, particularly other religions. And the American ideal of democracy and democratic republics overseas is to allow states to become what they want to become. Imperial states conscript soldiers and force them from colonies to fight against their own people or to fight in other far-flung battles. In none of these criteria, and not in the most important criteria, which is the control of sovereignty, in none of these criteria have the Americans been an imperial power in the 20th century. It's just it's an amusing parlor game.
Well, perhaps, and yet you know that this is and can be argued often. We heard Paul Kennedy argue it there, and you can surely hear in your own ear the voice of a counter view that would say we rub out cultures with Hollywood, we conscript soldiers through alliance and coalition, the globalization protesters would loudly proclaim that we have exploitive economic relations with the rest of the world, and even
I think that's what I object to most about. These are analogies. These are cultural imperialism is the phrase often used. That's not really imperialism. It's a potent and provocative way of expressing something. That is, that American ideas, American clothes, American Coca-Cola, American movies have a tremendous attraction to many cultures around the world. American business practices, because they are sometimes more profitable, have a great appeal. I've watched my bank here in London, where I've lived off and on for 20 years, become almost impossible to deal with as they've adopted more and more American practices and have done away with the sort of cozy relationship you used to have with bank managers. I watch British TV become sort of degraded by our influence. But it's not because we enforce that on them and require them to show American programming.
Philip, I want to put the question to our listeners and then turn back to you. The question is, really, is America the center of a new world empire or an old one? Or, to look at it another way, is empire even still a useful way to look at concentrated global power, at American power? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Philip Bobbitt, you've written so persuasively about a new world emerging in your book, The Shield of Achilles. Empire or not, whatever label you put on it, we are looking at a mountain of American power, and clearly, especially post-9/11, Americans are very attuned to this issue of how we should think about it. Is it an advantage? Is it a disadvantage? Are we using it wisely? Are we not using it wisely? Does it bring peace and order, or does it invite attack and chaos? What's your sense of the basis of American power right now and the evolving manner in which it is being exercised?
You know, those are exactly the right questions. I'm not sure they have either or yes-no answers. I think we are becoming more powerful, and we are becoming more vulnerable. I think that the state system is changing in some ways in our direction, but it's also changing to a new form that we, and no one else, has a monopoly on, a form that will become increasingly less territorial. The big events in my lifetime have been strategic and constitutional in nature. The development of a universal system of human rights, for example, so that every state has to obey certain rules, whether or not that reflects their national laws. Mm-hmm. An international system of trading and finance that takes control of currency away from states, including our state. A global communication system, of which you are a part, and it has the penetration that some of your speakers deplored. Transnational threats like damage to the environment or disease and epidemics, but above all, the development and dispersal of weapons of mass destruction. Now, these are things that affect all states, and they...
Including the most powerful.
Including the most powerful, and I very much doubt, were our power to wane, that we would find ourselves in any better position for dealing with them, but I also doubt that our power is sufficient to ignore these changes.
But you've also written that collaboration, that coalition, may be key to keeping the world from descending into a radically disordered state.
I have, and I think that's a terribly important point. I'm glad you bring it up.
But how does hyperpower sit side by side with collaboration, with coalition? This seems to be right at the heart of debate in Washington, in the Bush White House right now. Do we just pick up our cudgel and say this is the way it's going to be, which looks imperial, whatever we call it, or do we, will we, must we collaborate in coalition?
I think it's a very important point. Hyperpower, which, as you know, is a term of opprobrium attached to us by the French, is not, I think, consistent with coalitional warfare. I think the biggest objection I have to the imperial debate, because I don't own the word, and if people, political scientists, want to say we have an empire, I suppose the word will change. The biggest problem is that it puts an obstacle in the road of what ought to be our greatest opportunity.
That being?
To build coalitions, to find a way to cooperate with other states in wars of intervention for human rights and humanitarian reasons, wars against terrorists who, after all, threaten many states besides the United States, many weaker states. Most terrorist casualties occur outside of the United States and have for a long time. This ought to be a moment of great opportunity for us. And looking at it as though we are an empire, either our enemies who would like to pin that label on us, or even our friends who don't want to go through all the messy and difficult negotiations it takes to maintain a coalition, are throwing away a tremendous opportunity.
What's the shift in nation-state character, in the relationship of powers globally that you see us heading into? You write of market states, that there will be non-territorial or non-nation-state entities that I believe you say are already strong enough, witness al-Qaeda, to threaten, to menace this great power of the United States.
Yes, that's been a tremendous change, and that is a sort of pivotal point in history. Really, ever since the development of the modern state at the time of the Renaissance, for five centuries now, it has taken the resources of a state to destroy another state. Only states could muster the huge revenues, conscript armies, sufficient number, equip them to threaten the survival of another state. Now, this is no longer true. We used to know, every state knew, where our enemies came from, and that was the basis for a strategy of deterrence through retaliation. Today, owing to advances in telecommunications, transit, rapid computation, and supremely weapons of mass destruction, that simply isn't true. Statecraft will have to change. It will have to be able to cope with adversaries who, sometimes in very small numbers, can wreak greater harm and threat against us than very powerful states could do in the past.
Jack Beatty, just got a few seconds, but this clearly makes the issue of our power, however you define it, and the way that we use it, seem critical. We are now threatened, as Philip Bobbitt says, by entities we would not even have considered visible maybe only 9 months ago.
Yes, and it's almost as if, to put this, I guess, in the Roman, and I too feel this word empire is overused, we need to transcend the temptations of empire in order to come to grips with our current enemy.
We're talking about an American empire, yay or nay, does it exist or not? Pax Americana and all that power entails at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American power, perhaps American empire, the notion of Pax Americana, or perhaps not peace, not an age of American power in the century ahead. Is America the center of a new world empire? What should America's world role be today? And does the world need America to keep order or to back off? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in studio by On Point senior news analyst Jack Beattie, a senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine, and from London, England, by Philip Bobbitt, author of The Shield of Achilles, War, Peace, and the Course of History, just published last month by Knopf. Philip Bobbitt, there is a notion around today that whether or not the United States is an empire, it's time to act like one. That is, to reach out and actively organize, oversee, impose order on a world that since September 11th has looked pretty darn scary.
Well, I don't think we could really do that, even if it were in our interest to do so. The kind of work that will stop, for example, a group like Al-Qaeda depends supremely on cooperation. You have to have the cooperation of foreign intelligence services, a foreign banking system, foreign systems of airline and transit. All have to operate with us. Now, let me be clear about this. The U.S. must lead. When we do not lead, as in Rwanda or in the struggle in Bosnia for several years, you see what happens. The U.S. has to lead. I don't think we can hide from these problems. I don't think we can simply offer up ourselves as a forum for other states to discuss alternatives. But leading is not the same thing as commanding, and we cannot command a coalition to come into being. We have to do so by adroit leadership.
Jack Beattie, leadership is not the same as commanding. Does history bear that out in your mind? When the United States stands up and says, we must lead, has it most effectively commanded or built coalitions?
It seems to me it has built coalitions. It has bent with history. I mean, that has been no country can resist the tide of history. And when we went wrong after World War II in thinking that we could resist nationalist movements by calling them, as in Vietnam, outliers of international communism, we went against the impulse of the post-war era, which was to throw off colonial and late imperial rule. And so I think that that the country's if we have anything going for us, it is a pragmatic turn of mind that we have in our non-ideological moments, which allows us, I think, to adapt to new situations. Witness the way this experience of World War I having shown us that disengagement from the world would not work. We completely reinvented ourselves for the new challenges after World War II.
And so here we are at the peak of power, perhaps wondering exactly what the pragmatic path is. It's
right.
Not necessarily so clear when you hold all this power. Jack, Phil Bobbitt, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Max Boot. Max Boot is author of Savage Wars for Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. He's editorial features editor at the Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Max Boot.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. Max Boot, you've been listening to some of this conversation and a bit of the documentary that we heard before. You have written that it is, in fact, time for America to be more expansive in its goals, more assertive in their implementation, that the problem is insufficient assertiveness. And the question is whether, having now been attacked, we will act as a great power should. You wrote that rather presciently in October last year. I'm curious, what's your initial assessment? Here we are 8 months on now. In your view, is the United States acting with sufficient assertiveness? And by that, do you mean that we should act imperially?
I think it's too early to tell in some ways whether we are acting sufficiently assertively or not, because as you say, it's only been 8 months and the verdict of history takes years to deliver. I mean, I'm very encouraged by some of the things that we've done in Afghanistan. I think we've acted brilliantly in many ways and done some of the things that we've done so successfully in past counterinsurgencies, in past small wars that I write about in my book. But the question now is, are we going to step up to the imperial responsibility and to do more to build a stable, long-term situation in Afghanistan so that it has not once again become a breeding ground of terrorists? Are we going to do more to support the Karzai government and to put more peacekeepers in and to stamp out some of these warlords that are going to try to undo some of the gains that we've made in the last several months. Now, beyond that is the question of Iraq, of course, which looms before us all. And the question there, I think, is not only are we going to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but what comes after Saddam? And I think that if we're going to act as a great empire should, and I think in many ways we are a great empire, we need to try to create a much better situation in Iraq post-Saddam than to merely have some Ba'athist colonel take his place. I think we need to try to build a liberal democratic regime in Iraq, if at all possible, on a federalist model. The same way that we helped to create peace and stability in Germany, Japan, and Italy after World War II, I think we need to think about doing the same thing in Iraq and creating a bastion of liberalism and democracy in the middle of the Arab world.
And interestingly, Max Boot, you don't really step away from the legacy of imperial power. You say that Afghanistan and other troubled lands today cry out for the sort of enlightened foreign administration once provided by self-confident Englishmen in jodhpurs and pith helmets. Mm-hmm. Phil Bobbitt, you heard earlier, says it's all about coalition building. Do you buy that, Max Boot, or are you saying Americans get on your jodhpurs and pith helmets, take the place of the old thin red line, get out there and administer other nations of the world toward order?
Well, if necessary, I think we ought to do that. I mean, clearly, we're not after the same kind of territorial empire that Britain or other nations had in the 19th century. But at the same time, we have to recognize, as Paul Kennedy pointed out in the documentary, that much of the British Empire was also informal in nature. They didn't want to exercise direct rule either. And likewise, we exercise direct rule very reluctantly, and only in a few places like Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, where it becomes really necessary. But sometimes it does become necessary, and I think we have to step up to the plate. And in terms of empires, I mean, the notion that imperialism is a term of opprobrium is one that has taken hold in the last several decades, but I don't think that the verdict of history bears that out. When you look at all the good that the British Empire did in the world, when you look at the Middle East or the Balkans, I mean, are they really better off under the nationalism that we've seen in the last several decades, or were they better off under the Ottoman or Habsburg empires? I think a good argument can be made that the Ottoman and Habsburg empires, for example, in the Middle East and in the Balkans, look pretty benign by comparison with what followed them, when we've seen the horrors of nationalism and tribalism unleashed, that relatively benign multinational institutions administering troubled lands doesn't seem like such a bad solution. And I think we need to think about new ways of doing that today, whether it's through United Nations mandates or through the kind of international administration we've seen in places like Bosnia and Kosovo in the last several years.
You know, there's so much that you say that I agree with, and particularly some of the ideas in your new book.
Phil Bobbitt.
Yes, but there is a certain sort of argument you're making that I find very troubling.
And that is?
When we say of a particular historical event, are you better off now than you were then? When we contrast a current situation with something in the past, we are often led to think that golden time in the past could exist now. I think you can make a good case that the subcontinent was safer under Britain than it is under Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India. But that was not an imperial rule that could be sustained. You can make a very strong case that had the Habsburg Empire continued, you would never have had the horrors in Yugoslavia you had. But that really wasn't possible. That is not a sustainable proposition.
No, I agree. I mean, but I think we have to reinvent some of these ideas for a new world order today. And I think we are doing it. I mean, you are seeing, in effect, imperial rule in Bosnia and Kosovo today. It's not called imperial rule, but that's ultimately what it is. And I think we have to think about a similar construct in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And in a lot of these places, you don't even need to rule directly. Merely the presence of American troops is a very positive influence, as we've seen in states like Germany, Italy, South Korea, all of which have really been transformed into democracies. And most of it was not through direct American rule. Most of it was just by having American troops in the vicinity, which creates a very stabilizing, positive influence for change towards a liberal democratic direction.
But Phil Bobbitt, what about all the notions of self-determination and sovereignty and rejection of imposition of culture and even governmental systems that, you know, most Americans have been weaned on in the middle and late 20th century? is it Max Boot, is ready to pick up the jodhpurs and the pith helmets? Do we have to have that kind of approach to active engagement in the world? Does it have to have that kind of imperial legacy or patina on it, or is there a new way?
I think you go right to the heart of the matter. That is exactly the right question. And I think there is a fundamental contradiction in Mr. Boot's plans. On the one hand, he is, I think quite rightly so, very much in favor of democratic republics and the pluralism that brings. On the other hand, he insists that he wants to revive a kind of imperialism that is inconsistent with that. The reason why we succeeded in Germany and in Korea and in Japan was only partly because we had troops there. There aren't enough American troops in the world to garrison states that large and that powerful indefinitely. We succeeded because we had an idea, and the idea was democratic republics that reflect the desires of the people there. Now, that is not an empire.
Well, no, I agree with what you're saying, but I don't think we would have succeeded without the presence of American troops.
Absolutely.
American ideals are great, but I think people who say we should just put our ideals out into the world and let people take them or not are being Pollyannish. I mean, we can't assume that in the face of warlordism and dictators and so forth that our ideals will naturally triumph. I think they need a little push along the way. If you look at the history of democracy over the last 200 years, the expansion of democracy around the world has been due mainly to Anglo-American arms and the success of Anglo-American armies. That's what's responsible for the expansion of democracy. And
Max Boot, Philip Bobbitt, stand by for a moment. A lot of people want to join this conversation. We're talking about American power, perhaps about American empire. Is America the center of a new world empire? Is the notion of American empire attractive or abhorrent to you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255, and a lot of people are lined up to do that. Bernadette is on the line. Welcome, Bernadette. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that, when we started this conversation, the question was on the table, is America an empire or not? And
yes,
we've gone somewhat farther than that at this point. But the thing is that I think we need to behave and recognize that regardless of whether we see ourselves as an empire, many, many people throughout the world, many countries, especially those that feel oppressed by our power, do see us as an empire. And it breeds a complicated relationship with us. On the one hand, they may envy our power. They may long for our leadership in certain ways. But in other ways, they're extremely resentful of the way that we use that power and the way that they feel whether it's their culture, their economy, their loss of sovereignty. And if we don't behave in the world as though we understand that and appreciate that and move more in the direction of what Mr. Bobbitt had said in terms of coalition building, I think we're doing ourselves a grave danger.
But Bernadette, Max Boot writes that if we complete the task in Afghanistan, really bring it to ground, then go into Iraq and depose Saddam Hussein, that American seriousness and credibility will be restored. He writes, we will enjoy fruitful cooperation then from the region's many opportunists who will show a newfound eagerness to be helpful in our larger task. So in other words, he's saying, don't worry about being seen as an imperial power. In fact, be seen because it will elicit cooperation, shall we say.
And I think we've seen evidence of that since September 11th, because on September 11th, you saw throughout the Arab world, people were on the streets cheering. And why were they cheering? They were cheering because they saw America brought low. They thought that America had been defeated, that we were a victim. And then everybody predicted if we attacked the Taliban that there would be outbreaks on the Arab street, but they didn't happen.
Bernadette, I want to get Bernadette's view on this. No. Bernadette, are you there?
Yes, I just think it's ludicrous. I think that, the idea that we will win friends around the world by basically deposing states as we did in the days of the Cold War when we deposed Allende and we deposed Jacobo Arbenz and we installed, dictators all over the place, that's going to somehow restore our credibility is absolute, fallacy.
Bernadette, thank you for calling. We're glad for your view. Philip Bobbitt, coming here with a 21st century view for us, is there a way to responsibly exercise power in a way that keeps the bicycle upright and going forward that does not, rightly or wrongly, invite this kind of deep resentment that we saw explode on September 11th?
Maybe not. It may be that there'll always be states, and there'll always be individuals, and there may always be groups that define themselves against the most powerful. That just may be part of human misery. And I don't think that should deter us from leading and from acting. My concern is that at this moment, we have a great opportunity. And a lot of this lies in the sort of wars that Mr. Boot has written about, wars that really only we can lead.
These are small wars where you go in, there's a fire, someone's got to put it out.
That's right. If you look at, for example, the work in Afghanistan, which I think was a triumph, it was not done just by the Americans, but it would not have been done without the Americans. If you look at our relationships right now with Russia, they are stronger than they have ever been in my lifetime. And I think that is because we face a common enemy, and you've had, I think, excellent leadership both in Washington and in Moscow on this issue.
Philip Bobbitt, I want to get one more question before the break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to address a different aspect of imperialism, and that was cultural arrogance. And what I've noticed since 9/11 is the step up in rhetoric, especially among conservatives like David Price Jones and Mark Stein, who have adopted this diffusionist attitude that everything that's out of Europe is great, and then everything now, in particular the Islamic world, is basically nothing. And, I mean, I've heard them say publicly, well, what has the Islamic world contributed in the modern world except for exporting of ideology? And I find this kind of mentality to be no different than European colonialism during the 19th and early 20th century, which was, what do these savages really know? We're going to tell them what's good for them. So I just wanted to know if you guys could kind of comment on that aspect.
Imran, thank you for your call. Jack Beatty, Imran's points to the cozy relationship between power and chauvinism.
Yes, and ignorance. I mean, when we began our imperial venture, quote unquote, in the Philippines, someone asked President McKinley why we were doing it, and he said, "Well, we want to Christianize the people." Of course, they had been Catholic for 450 years.
A little late.
I think this cultural arrogance and cultural ignorance are really part of one of our main vulnerabilities in the world today. We are, you know, people have been vaunting in that documentary that everybody speaks English. Well, we're also trapped in English. I mean, we don't pay attention to other nations until something like this happens. And I think that for Americans, they don't see that as arrogance. They just see that as, well, we're just being Americans. But the rest of the world says, we are out here too, and we have our centers of gravity and our cultures, and you just can't assume that you're going to have, you know, dominance over us, or you can't just ignore us and pretend that we're not here. So I think, he's absolutely right. This is a real American vulnerability.
And right now, a dilemma: how to handle all this power, how to best deploy it. Listeners, does America have a choice about playing the imperial role? Is it a responsibility we cannot duck, or is it the problem? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American power, perhaps about American empire. The question for listeners: what should America's world role be today? In the 21st century, does great power equal empire? Can an imperial scale America bring this world to order, or is something else required? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from London by Philip Bobbitt. He's author of The Shield of Achilles, War, Peace, and the Course of History, and by Max Boot, features editor of The Wall Street Journal. He's author of Savage Wars for Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power, just published last month by Basic Books. Philip Bobbitt, you, in speaking to the relevance, I guess indirectly, of this whole notion of imperial power or of concentrated power, you write about the rise of a new kind of state. You call it a market state, and you distinguish it from what we've known throughout the 20th century as the nation state. What's the difference, and what difference does it make to the American exercise of power in the century ahead?
Nation states of the kind that we've had since in our country, since Lincoln, in Europe, since Bismarck, had a fundamental compact which could be phrased, give us power and we will better the material well-being of the people. Hitler said this, Stalin said it, Lenin said it, but FDR said it and Woodrow Wilson said it. They all They had different ideas about how to achieve that, but that was the fundamental promise. The sort of state you can just begin to see emerging now after this, the end of this long 20th century conflict, which settled the debate about the best way to improve the material well-being of people, the kind of state you can see emerging now has a different compact. It says, give us power and we will maximize your opportunity. It is much less concerned with using law to enforce national ideals and goals, and much more about relying on the market and using various incentives. And you can see this in the policies of President Bush, Chancellor Schroeder, Prime Minister Blair. You could see it in President Clinton's policies.
What does it say about the exercise, then, of national power or state power?
I think it says several things. One, it I'm afraid, portends a period when you will see tremendous conflict, both within states, as certain groups try and cling to the old form and try and use the power of the state to, through law, to advance their moral and political agenda. Mm-hmm. And you'll see conflicts among states where peoples who do not have states, like the Palestinians or like the Kurds, people in Kashmir who feel the state does not reflect their national goals, use violence to try to achieve a state. The state was born in violence. It was born to manage violence within this territory and to protect that territory from violence outside. And states will always be creatures of violence. Market states, as I feel are emerging irresistibly, will also be creatures of violence too. But they will be creatures that have to face a whole new set of problems. And one reason why we are making this transition is because the problems that are emerging now are not ones the nation-state can handle.
Max Boot, do you buy that analysis? Do you think the nation-state is obsolete, that it's now in the hands of market dynamics, loosely taken advantage of by states? I'm a bit reminded of the kind of talk we heard in the late 90s of the dot-coms, the gazelles that would spring past the big old-fashioned corporations, and here we are a few years later, and the big old corporations are still kind of riding pretty tall in the saddle.
Well, I think Mr. Bobbitt is onto something. I mean, I think he's describing a real phenomenon. I don't think he thinks that the nation state is going to disappear. But I think clearly what we're seeing is that for a good many decades, we tried to pretend that every tribal area in the world, every group of people was a legitimate nation state with every bit as much legitimacy as France or Britain or the United States. What we're seeing now is that those nation states were really artificial constructs and created by European imperialists, which are now breaking apart, and it's creating a very chaotic world. And in a lot of ways, I think that the chaotic world today resembles the post-Napoleonic world, without a lot of powerful nation states around to challenge the dominant power, whether that was Britain in the 19th century or America today. But there's a huge demand for somebody to impose law and order upon these increasingly lawless areas in the world, in places like Central Asia, Africa, the Middle East, the Balkans, many of the same places that were lawless in the 19th century. There's a huge demand for somebody to come in from the outside and impose law and order. And today, the only state capable of doing that is the United States of America. And I think if we're going to have a peaceful 21st century, we're going to have to step up to that role and realize that if markets are going to flourish, they're going to have a security protection behind them, and we're the only people who can provide that security guarantee.
Jack Beatty, step back from this conversation with me for a moment. The Max Boot solution is pull up your socks, put on your jodhpurs, be the power that you are, intervene where you need to intervene. It's for the good of all, ultimately. Phil Bobbitt, effectively, and forgive my summary here, but it's intervene, but do it as a coalition. But you must still be actively asserting power in the world. What's your level of confidence, A, that we've got the moral wisdom to do this without creating more havoc than we solve? I guess, are you ready for the United States to drop the opprobrium from the power word or the imperial word, whatever you like, and stride back out there and solve the darn problems of the world?
I'm tremendously ambivalent about it. When Philip Bobbitt says that the universal human rights, that this is one of the great sort of givens of our new world, I want to applaud. The idea of sovereignty used to mean you can't look inside my nation. That's my business. Mm. And, you know, with the globalizing economy, the conscience has globalized, too. And I think that is a tremendous gain for humankind. And I don't want to see that lost. And I don't want to see the United States by, for example, removing itself from world jurisdictions and courts and so on, breaking away from that. That should be our strength, because to get back to what I said originally, we are the city upon a hill. We do have a Bill of Rights and a Constitution that in theory and in lot in practice gives us rights. And so I guess I'm saying our best kind of power, I think, is there in the sense that we stand for not just power relations and not, as Mr. Boot says, we're going to come in and put law and order, but for the universal craving people have for dignity and for well-being and human rights. And that's our strength, I think.
Well, I don't think those two things are incompatible. I think we can be
Max
idealistic,
Boot.
And at the same time, we have to realize that idealism by itself isn't going to accomplish what we want. I mean, let me just make one other point, which I think is relevant here, which I make in my book, The Savage Wars of Peace, which is that there's this myth that America has traditionally been isolationist and that this is a great danger, and so therefore it's unnatural for us to want to go around policing the nether regions of the world. In fact, as I said, this is a myth. If you look at the history of our involvement overseas, it's always been there. Between 1800 and 1933, the U.S. Marines staged 180 landings abroad. I mean, that's an amazing figure. That's more than one a year throughout most of the 19th century.
So the cop has been on the beat.
Absolutely. There's a long American tradition of that, and that's what I try to resurrect in my book, is that memory that we've forgotten, that we have played this kind of role before.
Max Boot, Phil Bobbitt, stand by. There's so many callers who want to come in. I want to invite them. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I had 2 points. One is I'm surprised that your guests are talking about the U.S. going in and helping create democracy, where if you look at Iran, Chile, or Nicaragua, we explicitly went in to take away democracy to better fulfill our global aspirations. And the other is, I haven't heard too much talk about how American intervention is very often as a result of the desire to help large corporations that are based in America to establish their markets, not to help the people in the countries, but to establish markets for their goods and get cheap labor.
Chris, here they are, the questions, and thank you for raising them. Philip Bobbitt, let me put those to you. Chris points to, obviously, a checkered record when you look at the United States power being applied in the interest of democracy or necessarily even human rights, and the close link between that and corporate power, the extension thereof. Does the era of market states mean that the expression of American power will be even more aligned with corporate interests, or can we keep it? Can we do better than we have in the past in aligning it with democratic interests?
Well, I'd like to answer both of those questions. The first question about the past, I think, is something I often hear from my students or I hear from people overseas, and I think it is a misreading of history. Yes, it's true that during the long war from 1914 to 1990, we went many, many places.
And you lump all those wars together into one long war.
I do, because it was about the issue of whether or not fascism or communism, or parliamentarianism.
And we know there were good... I'm sorry.
No, please.
And we know there were good wars, and wars that, in retrospect, Americans are less proud of in that period, where, as you say, communism, fascism, and parliamentary democracy were duking it out. But
there were some times when we had to ally ourselves with some pretty unsavory characters. But if you look at the overall sweep of what the Americans have done in the last... in this century during these wars, I think it's an amazing success.
And the trend line, is it toward the good war ideal, or has it drifted?
I think it's overwhelmingly a success for human rights and for the dignity of man.
Can I just quickly agree with Mr. Bobbitt and just add one fast point?
Max Boot.
Which is that the wars that are often caricatured as being done exclusively for capitalist interests, for Wall Street, are the banana wars, our interventions in Latin America in the early years of the 20th century.
The small wars, as you described them.
And I write about those wars in my book, The Savage Wars of Peace, and what I found was that this is just a gross caricature of those interventions, that they were not done exclusively at the behest of big capitalist interests, that they had a huge moral and ideological component, and the most active interventionist present was Woodrow Wilson, who proclaimed his desire to teach the Latin republics to elect good men. So a lot of those interventions really have a lot in common with our interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo.
Woodrow Wilson, the great idealist. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Just a quick comment. I think something that Jack Beatty alluded to is important to remember, and that's that if the United States is going to launch into this new era of imperialism, it has to lead by example. For instance, we can't unsign treaties like the International Criminal Court. We can't not sign treaties like the Kyoto Protocol. We can't preach free trade as a moral imperative while protecting our own market.
Mm. Good point. Phil Bobbitt, do we have consistency there?
Well, I think the strongest point the caller made is the third one. And he may want to look at a new book by Joseph Stiglitz on this issue about globalization. Stiglitz, at the time, was the chief economist for the World Bank, and he'd been head of, the Council of Economic Advisors. As you know, he's a Nobel laureate in economics. Mm-hmm. And he says that we really talk out of two sides of our mouth, that we want to enforce free trade on many societies for whom it may not be the very best thing to develop their own industries, but we are very reluctant to apply it to our own industries, and we have been inconsistent. Now, I don't know the facts, but this book is quite persuasive on that point.
Our time is running low. I want quick questions. First, to get this right up to date, first, Max Boot, as briefly as you can, keep us real here. How is your view expressed in the Weekly Standard last October? How has it become or not become part of the Bush White House view of the world? Do we now have a Bush White House ready to go out and put on the pith helmet and do the necessary to bring or impose order?
I think it's one view within the Bush White House. I don't think it's necessarily the dominant view. I think the Bush White House has really been critical of peacekeeping, which I think is a mistake. I think that's something we need to do in some troubled regions of the world. And you see a lot of disarray within the White House over what we're going to do in Iraq, which I think is going to be really a test case. And it's still unclear to me what exactly we're going to do. I think at this point we're still where we were for the past decade and kind of hoping against hope that some colonel will come along and bump off Saddam Hussein and get rid of this problem.
And very briefly, do you hear the White House warming to the word or the perspective imperial?
Oh, no. I don't think they're going to go around saying that we're an imperial power. I mean, if you remember back to 1992, Paul Wolfowitz, when he was Undersecretary of Defense, got into a lot of trouble for putting the word preeminence, that we want to preserve American preeminence, mm-hmm. into a planning document. So I don't think this is something the administration needs to proclaim, mm-hmm. but I think among those of us who think about these issues, I think we need to be honest about what we're doing and say there's nothing wrong with being a great imperial power.
And Philip Bobbitt, last question, and we have only a minute here, but why has the Bush administration, in your sweep of history view, been so coalition averse?
Well, we suffered a tremendous blow. It was an attack, very much, in my opinion, like the attack on Pearl Harbor, for very similar reasons. And in self-defense alone, I think we had both a law and strategy on our side. I think the president has not been averse to coalition building, but I think he said that when we're struck, we're going to defend ourselves, even if we have to do it alone. And I think he's absolutely right.
Philip Bobbitt, thank you for joining us tonight.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Philip Bobbitt is author of The Shield of Achilles, War, Peace, and the Course of History. And Max Boot, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Max Boot is author of Savage Wars for Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. Jack Beatty, you bring up the word empire, and suddenly we're talking about projecting power all over the place.
Yes, and straightening out other lands and going on these, you know, the whole idea of democracy and the bayonet, often they don't go together. Sometimes they have in Germany and Japan and other places. It's a mixed record, and redoing the map was a British pastime, not an American.
Our thanks to Michael Goldfarb and Inside Out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support.